Case number 10-5059. Jeremy Pinson et al. Appellants versus Charles E. Samuels Jr. et al. Ms. Murphy Johnson for the amicus curiae. Mr. Kelly for the appellee.
Ms. Murphy Johnson.
May it please the court, my name is Dawn Murphy Johnson, and I'm here this morning as amicus to present arguments on behalf of the petitioners in this mandamus action. Congress enacted the PLRA to restrict prisoner litigation, but Congress also provided the imminent danger exception as a safety valve for prisoners who would otherwise be barred from bringing claims under the three strikes rule. In addition, Congress provided a payment scheme that reflects the dual goals of restricting prisoner litigation while nonetheless leaving prisoners with some minimal funds. The petition in this case involves several issues. This morning I would like to focus on two. First, whether Mr. Pinson qualifies to proceed in forma pauperis under the imminent danger exception to the PLRA's three strikes rule. And second, whether the court should stay collection of the filing fees owed in this case by Mr. Bruce and Mr. Pinson if Mr. Pinson qualifies to proceed in forma pauperis until the fees they owe in cases filed prior to this one are paid in full. Let me turn to the imminent danger issue first. Mr. Pinson's request to proceed before this court in forma pauperis depends on whether he adequately alleged that he was under imminent danger of serious physical injury at the time he filed his complaint. The PLRA does not define imminent danger, and this court has not defined what imminent danger means in the context of this case. That is, when an inmate alleges that prison officials knowingly housed him with rival inmates such that he faced life-threatening conditions. This court should adopt the rule that a continuing practice by prison officials presenting an ongoing threat of injury constitutes imminent danger under the PLRA. This was the rule established by the Eighth Circuit in Ashley versus Dilworth, and such a rule is supported by this court's decision in Ibrahim versus the District of Columbia.
How would you distinguish that particular point from Judge Tatel's opinion in Mitchell?
In Mitchell,
I'll just read you the part that is relevant. I'll read you the part that I'd like to have distinguished if you can't. Could amicus, I assume this wasn't same firm, was it? Same amicus? Maybe not.
In Mitchell, I don't know.
Okay. Amicus contends.
No.
Yeah. Anyway, you're not bound even if it
okay,
were.
Thanks.
Amicus contends that Mitchell's complaint and IFP motion present two types of imminent danger. First, Mitchell alleged that even though BOP knew he had testified for the government, illegally transferred him to USP Florence, prison known for, quote, murders and assaults on anyone who has been known as a snitch, and where he was nearly murdered in October 2003. And the court said that wasn't enough.
Well, what it turned on in that case was that the petitioner alleged that he was ultimately attacked on one occasion. And in his complaint, he waited 17 months then to file his complaint, claiming that he was under imminent danger. And the court held that that was insufficient, and that to allege imminent danger based on a single incident of violence,
But was it only a single incident? It said the argument was he was transferred to a prison known for murders and assaults on anyone who's been known as a snitch.
Right.
Not just that he was nearly murdered. That was sort of an added point, not the only point.
Right, but my understanding of the court's decision in that case was that he was basing his allegations on that single incident, and that he either was required to file the complaint closer in time after that one attack, or he had to allege that there was some ongoing threat to him and that his complaint didn't adequately allege that there was some ongoing threat. He was attacked on one occasion, and then I've not seen the complaint in that case, but it sounded to me like he left it open as to whether he was still in danger or not. And in our case, Mr. Pinson has alleged in his complaint that certain BOP officials knew that he was a member or a former member of a gang, but failed to separate him from his known enemies and these enemies had vowed to kill or injure their rival gang members. And the complaint further alleges that hundreds of inmate-on-inmate attacks had occurred in the SMU, along with several hostage situations, that prison officials were aware of the violence in the SMU but failed to take reasonable steps to prevent further violence or separate rival gangs. And later, we know from Mr. Pinson's filings that one of the gentlemen who he sought to join this case below, Bobby Crowley, was in fact murdered by a rival gang member.
Well, what do we do with the later information, that is information after the filing of the complaint?
You can view it as evidence of the circumstances that existed at the time of filing. It doesn't appear that the violence in the SMUs changed at any point during Mr. Pinson's stay there, and that these later events are reflective of what the circumstances were like when he did file his complaint.
That would be the only way we could use it. We couldn't use it as an indication of a continuing threat to him.
That's correct. But I think
because if we were to look at that, we would also have to look at the fact that he's not in the prison at all anymore, right?
True, but that's, for our purposes, irrelevant. So you would have to decide.
For your purposes, irrelevant. I'm trying to decide whether for our purposes it's irrelevant. I mean, this is sort of the bitter with the sweet problem. Do we look at the time of the complaint, or do we look at anything that continues thereafter? I mean, if the only issue is imminent harm to him and he's no longer even in the place that he was alleging was harmful to him, then there certainly isn't any current imminent harm, at least with respect to the cases before us today.
Right. So it does seem that you have to decide whether you're going to look at later events or not. Right. And in the first instance, we would say you shouldn't.
At all. So we can't look at the part that helps you either.
Well, I'd love for you to.
I know. But you're an amicus. You're supposed to help us decide what the right answer here is. What's the right answer?
The right answer is that you should look at the circumstances as of the time the complaint was filed. That is what the statutory language reflects. That Section 1915G says that a prisoner with three strikes cannot use informa pauperis status to bring a civil action or an appeal unless the prisoner is under imminent danger of serious physical injury. So the use of the present tense, along with the statute's focus on the initial act of filing something, indicates that the exception applies if the danger existed at the time the prisoner filed.
I have to say intuitively that I understand your textual argument, but can you help explain why that makes sense? Because if you have a situation in which someone confronts a fleeting danger, say it's a danger because they're put into a cell with somebody for a half an hour, and they happen to somehow file a complaint, or half a day, they happen to file a complaint at that time, and then they're housed somewhere else. It seems odd in the overall context of the statute to say that they should be able to file, if you take as a predicate, that they're a frequent filer, that they're under the three strikes rule, because the overriding object of Congress was to disallow somebody in that situation from getting the benefit of IFP status. And then to say that the danger that understandably allows them to circumvent that, because we want to make sure that we can address claims of danger, is adjudicated, but that no longer exists. The person still remains a three striker. It seems odd to say that all you look at is the precise moment at which they filed the complaint. Why does that make sense?
There are two reasons why. The first would be that looking at actions past the time of the complaint would require courts to make a constant reassessment of imminent danger when Congress intended the imminent danger exception to be a simple procedural screening device. So anytime a prisoner appeared before a court in any form, whether in person or on paper, the court would have to go through this exercise every time, and that seems to be a waste of judicial resources.
Well, they would just have to ask whether the person is still in danger at the time that the IFP determination
We haven't made that determination yet, right? So wouldn't that cut it off at that point?
Well, going back to the statutory language, I would again say that it's based on the time of filing, not on the time that you make your decision.
Because of the word brings.
Correct. Because of the word bring and the word is.
And the word what?
Is.
Is, I see.
But also, to finish answering your question, it actually reflects what you posed in your question. Prison officials could temporarily alter prison conditions to moot cases or moot imminent danger status at will to make these prisoners' cases go away and effectively evade review, and prison officials shouldn't be given that power or that authority.
I take that point, and obviously that's a concern that should be taken into account in some fashion, but that's a concern that comes up on mootness issues generally, that there's a possibility that the conduct that is being complained of can be resuscitated. And so courts are used to, I think, engaging in that kind of inquiry
right.
to determine whether this is one of those cases in which, notwithstanding the fact the person has temporarily been removed from whatever status gives them an opportunity to file, there's still a possibility that they can come back. So it doesn't seem like it's foreign to the normal legal to take that into account.
And where the person has actually moved to a completely different prison in a different part of the country, it doesn't seem like it's at least on face, temporary decision made just to avoid this particular lawsuit and this particular. I mean, it would be an awful lot to do to avoid a lawsuit about transferring, which is the only thing before us, transferring from the District of Columbia to someplace.
I would point out that the filing from last week that the petitioners lodged with this court alleges, in essence, that their transfer out of the SMU in Talladega was, in fact, in retaliation for the litigation that's before this court. So that is what they've alleged, that BOP is, in fact, making mischief with this case by transferring them around the country to dismantle this litigation.
Right, but we have nothing other than a claim of that at this point, right?
That's true. Right. That is the claim that's before the court, right. though.
Okay.
I see that my time has already gone.
No, we're going to need to talk to you a little longer.
Okay. Okay. So if I could turn to Mr. Pinson's motion to stay collection of fees, which Mr. Bruce has joined. As discussed in the briefs, and I'm sure the court is well aware, there's a split among the courts of appeals on how filing fees should be collected when a prisoner owes fees for more than one case.
So on that, can I ask you a threshold question, which is under 1915(3)(b)(1), do you disagree that for purposes of B1, the inquiry is per case rather than per prisoner?
Yes, I agree.
You agree. And so mm-hmm. your view would draw a distinction between B1 and B2?
Well, I would. It's not clear from the statutory language. I believe that the statutory language is silent on how multiple filing fees are meant to be addressed. But
is it really silent? I mean, I get that it's, I mean, if we have to decide the better reading of it, which is what, unfortunately, is our obligation, B2 says after payment of the initial partial filing fee, which is a reference to B1, and therefore to the case in which it was filed, that sounds like that's a continuation of the per case reference, and that the clerk of the court is then the clerk of the court in that case. I tell you, there's not that much. I agree, there's not much to go on, but it does seem to me that the more likely than not reading is that B2 is supposed to be the next step of B1.
That reading has the implication of then potentially depriving prisoners of all of their money, and in B2, Congress expressly expressed its intent not to do so because...
Well, not to do so until we get to $10.
Right. So,
right? So that would still apply. It'd still get to $10.
Right. But by applying the per-case approach as opposed to the per-prisoner approach, there's a very real likelihood of prisoners not even filing frivolous actions, but, you know, actions that...
Why is that? Because they don't want to spend their canteen money. But they'd be making a... We've said in some of these other cases, they'd be making a choice about what they want to spend their canteen money on.
That's true, but I would just point you to the language in the statute that indicates congressional intent of not using this statute to deprive prisoners of all of their money for filing fees, and that they that Congress intended to leave them something at the end of the day to spend on other things, whether it's phone calls to loved ones or stamps to mail them letters. And I think that the Fourth Circuit in the Torres case struck this balance and found that the language is in fact silent as to how multiple filing fees are meant to be processed. And Torres, I think, honored congressional intent by striking that balance between inflicting an economic sting on prisoners by this initial partial filing fee in B1, combined with knowing that even after a prisoner is released from prison, these filing fees will still be owed. They follow them wherever they go. And balanced that with this directive in B2 of not depriving prisoners of all of their money. And so there is the deterrent effect with the per-prisoner approach. And while it's less, admittedly less of a deterrent than the per-case approach, it's still a deterrent nonetheless. And so combined with the threat of the three strikes rule, a 20% cap is sufficient to satisfy Congress's goals.
Can we talk about the standing questions on the other, particularly the issue about the motions to join file below?
Sure.
So I take it we don't have that motion. It hasn't been submitted.
That's correct.
We have no physical. The only evidence we have is a docket, which doesn't show it ever having been filed, right?
The evidence we have is in Mr. Pinson's filings before this court.
Yeah.
He has alleged that on two occasions, he and other prisoners attempted to file this motion in the district court. First, either on January 11, 2010, or January 14, 2010. The record is a little unclear on that one. So that was before the transfer order was entered. And then again on January 22nd, when he received the court's transfer order and he sent in his motion for reconsideration along with the motion
right.
for joinder
so,
again.
If there was such a document, he at one point had it because he quotes what he says it had. He's had ample opportunity to submit it, especially given that the government has harped on the fact that there is no such document. I don't know, is that enough for standing? I certainly doubt it would be. Even if we got past standing, how could we possibly get to the merits of whether mandamus would apply, mandamus requiring clear duty on the part of the court when we don't really even have the document that is alleged not to, to have been inappropriately rejected.
Right. I'm not sure that it requires to have the physical document. I think that his allegations are sufficient that this document existed. He has alleged who signed on to it, when it was attempted to be filed, when it was returned, what the district court clerk wrote on it, when it was returned. And I think there's ample evidence to have this court rule that the district court should be ordered to accept the motion for joinder, should they refile it.
It's even for mandamus purposes, because it does seem you have to establish a clear and indisputable entitlement to relief. And it's hard to see how you can have a clear and indisputable entitlement to relief based on an allegation about a motion that no one's ever uncovered.
I would just point to the evidence that's in the record. And that's
It wasn't sworn, right? The complaints aren't sworn. There's no affidavit. There's nothing like that. Nothing
correct.
That would subject.
It was in a motion right. or one of the memoranda that Mr. Pinson filed before this court. I don't believe it was sworn.
Are you making any argument as to the standing of people other than Pinson, assuming away the joinder motion?
I'm sorry?
If we don't have a joinder motion,
mm-hmm.
and let's just say that argument purposes that it doesn't exist. Do you have any argument at that point as to the standing of people other than Pinson to raise the transfer motion by way of mandate?
Well, the government has conceded that Mr. Pinson has standing
right.
to challenge the transfer order.
I'm assuming that he doesn't. Yeah, you're right that if he has standing, then If he can go forward on an IFP basis, then I'll take for present purposes that he has standing to do so.
Right.
But let's suppose that he's out of the equation because of IFP status, and then there's no motion for joinder pending.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have an argument that nonetheless somehow seeking mandamus relief from the transfer motion can go forward on the basis of the other individuals.
If Mr. Pinson isn't in the
yeah.
case? Oh, I see. It is admittedly much tougher. But there is some case law indicating that because they have an interest in the outcome of the case, that they could have standing.
Even absent the joint motion?
Yes.
So under that view,
Because the joinder motion thwarted their attempt to get in the case. And so they tried to...
He's asking what if there were no joinder motion? What if they never filed
one? Oh, what if they never filed
one? What if we concluded that there's no evidence that they ever filed one? Then is that...
Would they then have standing to challenge the transfer order?
Right.
I don't believe so.
Okay. All right. We'll hear from the government.
Good morning, Chief Judge Garland, Judge Srinivasan. May it please the court, my name is Wynn Kelly, appearing today on behalf of the government. As the court has noted, there are three core issues in this case. First, Jeremy Pinson failed to adequately plead the imminent danger exception to the statutory bar preventing him from proceeding in a case without full prepayment of the filing fee under the Prison Litigation Reform Act. Second,
let's just go one by one.
Yes, Your Honor.
So on that one, what about the point that he has subsequently alleged that he was attacked and a putative co-plaintiff has been killed, and all that occurred, as Judge Srinivasan pointed out, before we made a determination about IFP status?
If the court is going to look to subsequent information filed after the complaint and the motion for informed papyrus below, the court should also look to the subsequent transfer. We would also point the court to...
Before we get to that, what's the right answer to the question of whether we can look at anything?
The court instructed in Ibrahim that it should look to the complaint and the motion for informed papyrus for determining whether there is actual imminent and ongoing harm. Judge Tatel's opinion in Mitchell, when analyzing whether the court could look to its own research of additional cases for IFP, seemed to possibly expand that a little bit. It was a different issue. It was on whether the prisoner had actually accrued three strikes. But in Mitchell, this court did say that it could look to things that were not raised in the complaint and at the district court stage.
You mean could look to see whether the plaintiff was a three striker or not?
Yes, Your Honor.
That's sort of a legal. That's just a legal question.
Yes, Your Honor.
But on the facts, are we just uncertain as to whether we can look beyond the date of the complaint and the IFP motion?
In Ibrahim, this court seemed to state that the court could only look to the complaint and the motion for informed papyrus. As we noted in our brief, in Ibrahim, this court cited, I may get the pronunciation wrong, Sierra Paglini of the Seventh Circuit. For that proposition, the Seventh Circuit has subsequently gone back and revisited that issue in Taylor, and it said, actually, the court should not ignore obvious evidence in front of it. Then it would incentivize prisoners to make some sort of allegation of imminent danger merely to thwart the purposes of the PLRA.
Does that go both ways, then? That is, do we also not ignore other things before us that might indicate there's now imminent danger?
Yes, Your Honor, it certainly would cut both ways should the court look to that. We would also, if the court is going to look to the other allegations submitted in the record, we would also point the court to the case of Pinson versus Pacheco. It's an unreported case out of the Tenth Circuit at 424 Federal Appendix 749. The Westlaw site is 2011 WL 2064877. And in that case, the Tenth Circuit noted or affirmed the district court's finding that these specific allegations that Mr. Pinson made related to his stay in FCI Talladega, that in fact he was the aggressor. The court noted the documentation.
I'm confused. There's a case on exactly this point, on exactly this person that we haven't heard about until just now.
Correct, Your Honor.
From either side.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Is it res judicata or anything like that, collateral estoppel?
It is not. It simply speaks to Mr. Pinson's challenging of he raised a due process claim related to some good duty time that had been taken away from him related to allegations. So there's not a specific. It doesn't deal with his allegation of actual ongoing harm, but it does characterize his stay in FCI Talladega, which is why.
You said characterize something as he was the aggressor. An aggressor of what and what?
In his complaint before the district court, Mr. Pinson alleged that placement in the special management unit could potentially subject him to risk of harm, hypothetically.
And the court's 10th Circuit said?
The 10th Circuit, and so what, in response to Your Honor's inquiry, when you said, if we look to the other information, for example, the murder of Bobby Conley and the, quote, near stabbing of Mr. Pinson, the 10th Circuit, in examining some determinations made about his punishment, said, the document presented by plaintiff, Mr. Pinson, shows repeated disciplinary violations by plaintiff, not by other inmates, for threatening bodily harm, possessing a dangerous weapon, assault with serious injury, taking a hostage, setting a fire.
I'm sorry, since I don't have it in front of me, I just need a little more help. Is this court saying that either the death of Bobby or this attempted stabbing of Mr. Pinson did not occur? Anything like that?
They do not address
They don't address those incidents.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
This case deals with Mr. Pinson's seeking of a preliminary injunction and temporary restraining order related to his loss of good time credits but this is specifically during the FCI Talladega period.
Okay. When was that decision issued?
This was issued on May 26, 2011.
Oh, so it's been on the books for a while, or on the unpublished books for a while?
Correct.
Okay. Can you tell us anything about whether there was a motion for joinder or not, or you don't know any more than we do?
Your Honor, we do not know anything. The U.S. Attorney's Office was never served with such a motion.
We know that the U.S. Attorney's Office wasn't served.
There's nothing in the record besides the representation I just made that it has not occurred.
Well, I guess what I want to step outside the record for 1 minute. Has the U.S. Attorney's Office actually searched its files to see if there was this, whether there was, or is the answer just that we just don't know? Those could be two different things.
The answer is we just don't know. It's not in our case file.
Okay.
Skipping forward, I don't know if you have another question, but I want to skip forward to the transfer point. Actually, ask you a question about that. If you have something else,
certainly.
So, there are claims for declaratory and injunctive relief, and if those were the only claims in the case, would the transfer have been proper?
No, Your Honor. If the only claims were for declaratory and injunctive relief, then Mr. Pinson, venue may have been proper here.
So, because your brief doesn't even talk about those claims, and they raised it in their brief, and as I read your brief, I don't even think you engage on the reality that those claims exist in the case.
Your Honor,
does that affect the propriety of the transfer motion, that those claims actually do exist?
We interpreted the district court's transfer order to be following this court's very specific guidance in Kerman versus Thornburg, that when a plaintiff presents Bivens claims against government officials and has throwaway injunctive claims against very senior Department of Justice officials, the court may disregard those claims when determining what is an improper venue, and must look to 1391E as the correct venue provision.
Why do you call them throwaway claims? I mean, he's challenging the policy of having these separate units for gang members. That would seem like it would not be, I don't know whether it's true or not, or whether they do or don't, but that would be appropriate to name the head of the Bureau for that.
Well, the primary relief that Mr. Pinson sought was Bivens, and that's exemplified in the record at AA7 in his motion for informa pauperis, where when it stated what is the nature of your claim, he said Bivens. The complaint seeks monetary damages. Its allegations are against individuals, specifically in Talladega, as well as Atlanta and D.C. The Northern District of Alabama, should those injunctive claims be deemed valid, would still be a proper venue to entertain those the declaratory and injunctive relief sought. But the District of Columbia would not be a proper venue and is, in fact, the improper venue for the primary relief sought, which is the Bivens.
But it's not an improper venue for, I mean, you can call it primary, but it's not an improper venue for the declaratory injunctive claims.
Correct, Your Honor.
It's a proper venue for this.
Yes.
But is Cameron the case where it was a pendant claim, the claim about the non-Bivens act for the injunction action had become moot?
I believe Cameron was related to the low-salt diet.
Yes, it was.
So the prisoner in Cameron sought relief under the Eighth Amendment, claiming that the prison had been deliberately indifferent, that he had high blood pressure, hypertension, and that the policy as far as the food that was served and the medical care he received placed him in danger and sued the Attorney General, who oversaw the policy, as well as, I believe, the warden. And then, yes, Your Honor, subsequently he was transferred, and the district court found that it did have that the venue here was proper for the challenge, and this court said, actually reversed the district court.
Yeah, but at that point, it was just pendant claims, though, right? It wasn't. Because the injunction claim had been mooted, I may be wrong about this, I'm trying to reread this quickly. By the time of that judgment, wasn't it mooted, the injunction aspect mooted, so that all was left was a pendant claim, and we were saying, don't hold on to pendant claims. That nothing was mooted here, at least in the district court. Am I wrong? I may be wrong.
No, you're not correct. I see my time has elapsed. I just want to make sure it's okay.
Yes, of course.
Yes, Your Honor, they had been mooted, and if the court is going to look to that, it certainly may look to the same facts here where...
But the district court didn't know about the mooting.
Correct.
So the argument here was that this language in the district court's opinion, because none of the alleged events forming the basis of the complaint occurred in the District of Columbia, this venue is improper for litigating the claims. Now, that would be wrong if the injunction was not moot, and at that point it wasn't because he hadn't been transferred, unless he's maybe overreading the district court. I don't know if it's he or she. I apologize. Overreading Cameron.
She, Your Honor, Judge Cotticatelli issued the order of transfer, which was affirmed by Judge Kennedy. Mm-hmm.
So it's he and she.
Correct, Your Honor. The transfer certainly was not an abuse of discretion based on this court's instruction in Cameron, in that the injunctive relief as existed was a challenge to his placement in the special management unit in FCI Talladega. That decision was made in FCI Talladega. It was not made by Mr. Lapin, who has since been succeeded by Mr. Samuels as director of the Bureau of Prisons.
All right, thank you. Does Amicus have any time left? All right, we'll give you another minute or two.
I'd just like to address Mr. Kelly's characterization of the injunctive claims as throwaway claims. While the IFP form might have said Bivens on it, a reading of the complaint, it's clear that the entire thrust of Claim 1 is his attempt to have a court find that the SMU program as a whole is unconstitutional. And in his requested relief on page 10 of the appendix, he does list damages as part of his requested relief, but he also says he's asking for declaratory relief, declaring program statement 5217.01, that's the program statement that's established the SMU program, to violate the Eighth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. And he asks, too, for injunctive relief enjoining defendants from coercing inmates in special management units to interact and coming to physical contact.
Just kind of pause on this. It seems to me a stronger argument is that since their argument is based on Cameron, and Cameron is really a pendant jurisdiction case, which this is not, we don't have to get to this point.
Okay.
But we still have the, do you doubt that it would be, do you think it would be an abuse of discretion for the district court if the court had acknowledged this point? That is, that there is an injunction claim here, but the balance of convenience to the parties, et cetera, is somewhere else. Would it have been an abuse of discretion for the district court to transfer the case?
Under these circumstances, it was, because at a minimum, the district court didn't, under Starnes, allow the parties an opportunity to present their arguments.
Right. We have another case where we said where the party makes the argument in their motion to reconsider that that's sufficient, that there was a motion to consider here. So I'll leave that part out.
Okay.
I'm trying to get to the pure question of the transfer. Assume full process and assume the district court understood that the court could have kept it here. Would there be an abuse of discretion for transferring it?
If the court had applied the appropriate factors?
Yeah. I mean, do you think that you couldn't apply factors such that it would be appropriate to have venue in the district where the prison itself is?
Yes.
Sorry?
Yes.
You think it would be abuse of discretion?
No, I'm sorry.
It would not be
an abuse of discretion.
So we're sort of in the odd position of you're asking us to issue mandamus to prevent an action which the court clearly could have taken.
The court could have, but the court applied the wrong venue statute. The court then applied the wrong transfer statute and didn't afford the parties an opportunity to present their arguments as to why transfer shouldn't take place.
Is the relief for declaratory, the claim for declaratory injunctive relief, is that moot now?
Is it moot now?
Because of the transfer?
No, it's not.
Why is that?
Because under this court's decision in Scott versus the District of Columbia, when a prisoner challenges a broader policy, not just their own conditions of confinement, changes to those conditions later don't moot claims for injunctive relief. And also, as you alluded to earlier, there's also the problem of the voluntary cessation repetition issue.
Okay. Thank you. We'll take the case under submission. Ms. Murphy-Johnson, you were appointed to represent as amicus in this case, and the court is very appreciative of your efforts.
Thank you, Your Honor.